Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Turbo Time podcast. I'm your host, James Cook, the associate editor of Turbo Machinery International. For this episode, we'll once again be talking to the Mythbusters, Klaus Bruhn and Rainer Kurz. Klaus and Rainer, take it away.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to us again. We are today going to be talking about hydrogen and carbon dioxide, but really more about carbon dioxide. In some of our past podcasts, we've talked extensively about hydrogen. So our focus today is going to be really more looking at the technology that is required for turbo machinery for carbon dioxide and really looking at issues like what's so important about the decarbonized energy economy, how does that play into turbo machinery. What are some of the real interesting application and technical challenges of CO2 and the decarbonized energy economy applied turbo machinery? So that's kind of how we're going to start it off. And I'm going to let you just, Rainer, talk about some of the applications of carbon dioxide and what's so challenging about CO2.
There has been for the last 4 or 5 years this thing about are people going to invest money in making better CO2 compressors? Are people going to invest money into better hydrogen compressors? The reality is where we stand right now, you need a lot of hydrogen to make a centrifugal compressor worthwhile, and there is really nothing in the near future that would give us that amount of hydrogen. So again, we're now in the decarbonizing world, focusing more. There will be CO2 produced. Fossil fuels will not go away. So what are we going to do with the CO2? And in that context, there is a lot of compression required. For example, if we capture CO2 from the exhaust of fossil fuel power plants, that could be coal plants, that could be natural gas plants, and we want to capture that CO2, transport it to a sequestration site, then we will have to compress this CO2, sometimes in various steps, maybe to a certain pipeline pressure, and then from the pipeline into the sequestration site. And sequestration site, that sounds a bit abstract, but what it is, for example, old abandoned gas fields, things like that allow you to store a gas permanently. And it turns out that the most economic way of transporting the CO2 is to go to supercritical CO2, meaning to relatively high pressures.
Yep. And so I'm going to start off already violently disagreeing with Rainer about hydrogen. We are seeing hydrogen coming up in its relevant, especially on the area of ammonia plants and fertilizer plants. But since today we're going to focus on carbon dioxide, we'll keep that discussion and that fight for a future podcast. When you're looking at CO2 compression, what makes it so interesting is really not that CO2 is difficult to compress, right? CO2 is a relatively heavy gas, molecular weight around 42 or so, and that makes it, from a thermodynamic perspective, nice and easy to compress. The molecules are already kind of close, and so with relatively low head, meaning with relatively low energy input, you get a fairly high compression ratio per compression stage, and so you get very nice and high compression ratios out of it. But what happens is that also means other things. And these other things are, for example, that you get a high temperature ratio across each stage, and that you, in most applications that we're looking at for CO2, and it's not just carbon capture and sequestration, but it's also energy storage, and we're also looking at power cycles and heat pumps for CO2. And in all of these applications, if you kind of look at them, your pressure ratio starts off for compression at a relatively low pressure, suction pressure, somewhere around atmospheric or a little bit above atmospheric. But then you go to a, what Rainer mentioned, supercritical pressure. So somewhere around, it's above 1,100 psi, but in most cases, it's much higher than that. In most cases, you go to 2,200. And if you look at some of these heat pump or power cycles, then you actually go to something like 3,500 or so psi. That means now you have to cross what's called the critical point, which is basically where the phases of the fluid change from gaseous to liquid to supercritical. And at that point, all of your physical properties are changing drastically. And that makes it very challenging from a design perspective, when you design a compressor, you try to compress, you try to stay away from that point because all your physical properties are changing drastically, which makes it, you don't really know where you're as far as density, even if you're like 1 or 2% off on pressure ratio on head, then your density is going to be off by 2 or 3%. And so your next stage is going to be very difficult to design. So your volume flow is going to be off, your pressure ratio is going to be off, your density ratio is going to be off, your temperature ratio is going to be off. And the closer you're to the critical point, the more challenging that becomes. And pretty much all the process applications you're looking for, compression and also for expansion with CO2, go through that critical point, go above the supercritical point. If you're on the left of the critical point, you're kind of sort of on the liquid side. If you're on the right of that critical point and above the critical point, you're in the dense phase supercritical ratio. It's kind of somewhat of a gray area because physical properties change a little bit. But that's what makes it really, really challenging because you have to have a design for this very long compression process over very, very high compression ratios going through the critical process. There's other significant challenges with CO2, and we'll talk about them, but that's one of the major ones. That also implies that you need intercooling, right? Because if you have a high pressure ratio, you have a high temperature ratio across each stage. That leads to mechanical limits where you're just too hot for your temperature and you need to cool down your process fluid. But also from a thermodynamic perspective, if you intercool, you save significant amount of energy, power for your compression process. And so those two things drive you toward intercooling. We'll talk about that a little more.
Couple of things to add on the compression in the air in the supercritical area. There's a huge difference between different applications for CO2. For example, if I simply have to compress CO2 from, let's say, atmospheric pressure to whatever my pipeline pressure is, 2,000 pounds or 2,200 pounds, I simply can cool my way through that critical area. But if I want to build compressors, for example, for heat pumps or for supercritical CO2 power cycles, the inlet conditions for at least one of my compressors tend to be very close to the critical point, and then you get into all these difficulties that Klaus has just mentioned. By the way, the other fun stuff about CO2 is that CO2 has a very low speed of sound. So all your compressor aerodynamics are relatively close to the speed of sound, or actually in some areas above the speed of sound, which again makes aerodynamics a bit more challenging. The other thing is that because of its high density, the CO2 com the gas forces in the compressor that affect the rotodynamic excitations become even at the 2,000 or 3,000 pounds pressure that we were talking about quite challenging. So from a rotodynamic standpoint, CO2 is not one of the easier gases to deal with.
Yeah. So basically, if you're looking at rotodynamics, and Rainer mentioned that basically your fluid forces are driven by the pressure, the dynamic pressure on the blades and on the shafts, et cetera, on your moving parts, and that's driven by 1/2 rho v squared, and rho is density, and therefore it's basically linear with pressure. And this because you have very high pressure, you have very high, and you have very high density, you have very high fluid forces. So that's the challenge. Now the other thing, and Rainer mentioned that CO2 at its subcritical state has low speed of sounds, right? So that's, I guess, it's a challenge because you run into sonic issues and Mach number issues. But interestingly, once you go above the critical point, the CO2 speed of sound increases drastically. So some of the turbo machinery that's been considered and developed, for example, shock compression for CO2 machinery, really conceptually works very, very well above the below the supercritical point, but really isn't applicable all that much above the supercritical point, which is really in line with all compression, because once you're above the supercritical point, then you're in what's called the dense phase, which, are you now pumping the fluid? Are you compressing it? What's the difference at that point of time of point? Because you're really not seeing a lot of compression anymore. Your fluid is already so dense that it's acting more like a pump or like a compressor. And there's always a fight in our industry as to what we call it. We call it a compressor, we call it a pump. It doesn't really matter. If it's coming from a pump manufacturer, then it's called a pump. If it's coming from a compressor manufacturer, it's called a compressor. But fundamentally, at least from a fluid dynamics perspective, it does very similar things. Mechanically, there are differences, and those have more to do with the way they're designed and the speed at which they run.
I want to add two or three more things on the applications. One of the things is that I said earlier that the most economic way to transport CO2 in pipeline is it's in its supercritical state. The only problem when you do that is that you have to build yourself a new pipeline, which is not cheap. There are some efforts in the industry to use conventional natural gas pipelines to transport CO2, which basically saves you the money for a new pipeline, but which essentially then forces you to transport CO2 basically as a gas, not as a supercritical fluid, which increases the amount of power that you have to install to solve that transportation task. The other thing is when you sequester CO2, there is the pressure that you need to make with your compressor depends very much on the storage site. So there are storage sites where you don't need much more than 1200 or 1500 pounds. There are other storage sites, especially a lot of the subsea storage sites, that will go way over, way beyond 3, 4, 5,000 pounds discharge pressure, with again all the issues that you have with machines rotodynamically.
If you're looking at transporting CO2 at a lower pressure, and Rainer mentioned that, then you can use a conventional pipeline, especially if you've got one available. And that's very often considered for local, kind of not long distance transport. So if you have less than 100 miles or so, then you may as well use what you've got. But you have to consider that in many cases, you have to go to a higher pressure anyway because of the injection pressure that's required. The other thing that has to be considered when you transport CO2 in pipelines, and we'll get into the different kind of machinery that's being used for that in a second. But the other thing that does need to be considered is that CO2 very often coming out of some kind of separation process, be it pre-combustion or post-combustion from a power plant or direct air capture or other crazy schemes, that it has moisture in it. And in that state, it will form carbonic acid, which does attack regular carbon steels in the wells and other things in the pipeline. So you have to worry about carbonic acid and the corrosion issues that come along with carbonic acid. So you have to go through a dehydration process really before you transport it in pipelines, or you're going to end up with corrosion issues. And that applies for both subcritical or supercritical transport. It also then kind of plays into the type of machines that you use, right? So if you're looking at compressing CO2, let's say from something that's atmospheric to 2500 psi to a supercritical pipeline transport pressure, you're going to have to go through many stages, which then you want to match those stages at some point to a dehydration system. So you wouldn't probably dehydrate your fluid at atmospheric pressures. You do it at higher pressures because of the volume requirements. So you usually do it around 600, 700 psi. You can easily accomplish that with a centrifugal compressor or with a integrally geared also, which is also a centrifugal compressor. But you have bigger challenges with those kind of low compression ratios with recip compressors. So for those applications and for many applications, and I will talk about that a little more here in a little bit, centrifugals lend themselves much better than recip or screw compressors or diaphragm compressors or other crazy machines for CO2 compression.
We so far talked a lot about the case where the CO2 comes from power plants. What you currently and the current state of affair you have, however, is that a lot of the CO2 that gets sequestered today as we speak comes actually from natural gas, because a lot of natural gas sources actually carry the raw natural gas carries significant amount of CO2. There are some parts of the world where you basically have to deal with 30 or 40% CO2 in your gas. So it's a fairly standard process to remove most of that CO2 from your gas before you transport it in a pipeline, before you feed it into a power plant. Now that is done often with membranes. And these membranes work perfectly well. The only problem is they create a huge pressure drop. So you have a lot of compression of CO2 and CO2 natural gas mixtures in these plants even before you can start thinking about sequestering the CO2. And again, as Klaus said, in most of these applications, the volumetric flows are so big that besides all the other technology issues that you may have with reciprocating, they're simply too small. They cannot do the volumetric flows that we can do with centrifugal compressor.
Yeah, we see on some older installation, we see some reciprocating compressors because for small flows, they obviously lend themselves very well. But once you get into CO2 compression for power plants that are 500 megawatts or 1 gigawatt, which is kind of standard sized power plant, you're outside of the range of being able to use reciprocating compressors. And from an operation and maintenance and range and reliability perspectives, centrifugal compressors tend to be a lot better. Now, when you look at the centrifugal compressors, there's really two types that are being considered. One is your normal barrel type compressor, which means it's the in between bearings type compressor. And those are being used for CO2 compression, especially for what Rainer mentioned, sour and acid gas reinjection in oil and gas facilities, where you have to deal with when you produce oil and gas, where you produce a lot of CO2, and so you have to reinject that. But we're also seeing, from more of an efficiency perspective, we're seeing integrally geared compressors. And that kind of ties back not really to the reliability and availability perspective, because they tend to be a little lower in reliability and availability. They have a lot more moving parts. They have four pinions, a gear, ball gear basically. They have on each pinion, they usually have two seals. They have two bearings on each pinion. They very often have variable inlet guide vanes for flow control. So there's a lot of moving parts that can break that make them less reliable. But on the other hand, and that has to be mentioned, is they allow for a lot more intercooling. And I mentioned, and also Rainer mentioned earlier, that if you intercool, your process becomes more efficient. And I'm not saying the machine becomes more efficient, but the overall process. So the amount of power that's required for compression decreases drastically. And that has to do with the nature of CO2 and other heavy gases, that they basically are more efficient if you call what's called an isothermal compression path. It's a little beyond the need of this discussion to get into the thermodynamics of that, but it makes a huge difference in a compression process with CO2 if you intercool two times, three times, or seven times. There is the power difference, power required difference is somewhere in the order of 10, 15, or even 20% lower for a highly intercooled process versus a non-intercooled process for CO2 compression. And that's why we're seeing a little bit of a trend toward integrally geared compressors rather than centrifugals. But in most current applications, sour and acid gas rejection applications that are very, very high pressures, we still see barrel compressors dominating that field.
It was mentioned a few times, and you may ask yourself, okay, so what's going to drive these compressors? For example, in pipeline applications, traditionally the pipeline compressors are driven by gas turbines, which is very elegant because you basically carry the fuel for these gas turbines in the pipeline, and you don't have to necessarily worry about the electrical power supply being down because there's a blizzard going through the countryside and things like that. Obviously, when you transport CO2, you don't have that fuel, so you may have to drive your compressors with electric motors. Now, there are a lot of applications where there is some source of natural gas available. So there is a good chance that the drivers still remain gas turbines. And that's in particular true for these applications that I mentioned earlier, where you capture CO2 from a natural gas stream. But yes, there probably will be a higher percentage of electric motor drives driving CO2 compressors than comparable natural gas compressors. And then, of course, you have to think about is how am I going to start this thing? Because, for example, if you have integrally geared type compressors that Klaus mentioned, you can probably get quite some operating range driving it with a constant speed motor, whereas with many other compressors, you need the capability to vary your speed to adapt your compressor to whatever the operating conditions are. So that's going to be also interesting to watch how this issue is going to pan out.
Before we end this, I would like to talk about CO2 safety a little bit because that's very often overlooked. People just naturally assume that CO2 is an inert gas primarily, and therefore it is safe. But there's two things with CO2. It is obviously not explosive or flammable, so that's nice. But in large percentages, and when I say large percentages, I'm talking about 3 or 4% in air, for example. It will drown you basically because it will replace your oxygen in the air. And so it is actually somewhat dangerous in the sense that it also is heavier than air. And so it will come back to the ground fairly quickly if you have a big leak of CO2 from a CO2 compressor from a dry gas seal or something like this. And if you're in an enclosed space with that, unless you do something and you run very fast, you'll probably die. So this is something to consider with CO2. A lot of people look at it as a little bit, oh yeah, it's CO2 and harmless. But from a compressor and compressor design perspective and the safety aspect of it, we do need to worry about that. And that also brings us back to the sealing, dynamic sealing and static sealing technology that's being used. You have to be very careful to make sure that you don't have accidental leaks of CO2. When the dry gas seal fails, you can very often have significant leaks. If it's not a tandem or double seal, you can have significant leakage coming out. And so you need to worry about that too with CO2 because it can hurt you, and there are certain safety aspects with it. Before we move on, I guess the final thing I did want to talk to you and hear Rainer about where is CO2 machinery going in your opinion? I have an opinion. I want to hear your opinion.
Well, I mean, the applications are there are a number of new applications, and we talked about these. But what you will see is probably more focus on getting high flow, high Mach number impellers. There are probably some things on the rotodynamic side. That may allow you to get more stages into a single machine and to deal better with overhang impellers as they are in integrally geared machines. Where the really new applications are going to come in are in heat pumps and power cycles, because there the compressors will run under conditions that are not quite as usual as in the natural gas or in the oil and gas world. You're gonna run right on top of the critical pressure and temperature with all the changes in conditions that Klaus had mentioned. You may run at very high pressures. You may see higher temperatures. So there is a lot of potential in these cycles. And one of the things, by the way, I forgot to mention in this context, that there are heat pump cycles that at least during startup, the compressors will run in the two-phase region. So they will see massive amounts of liquid droplets, which is also a challenge.
Yeah, we see, and I totally agree here with Rainer. We're seeing significant challenges on those cycle, the power cycle. On the power cycle, you have the additional challenge that you often deal with very high temperatures, right? So you're dealing with something up to 700, 750 C, which makes it so you have a very energetic machine with a very high energy density, not just from a pressure, but also from a temperature perspective, especially on the expander side. On the compressor side, less so. And yeah, the challenge about operating near the critical point. The other thing we're seeing is from a carbon capture perspective, is really trying to squeeze more stages into a machine, squeezing more pressure ratio, because it becomes a question of how can I have a reasonably cost-effective machine but still maintain a high efficiency or low power demand. Because obviously, when you're looking at carbon capture sequestration in power plants, you want to reduce your parasitic load as much as possible, because the power plant's primary function is to produce electricity, not to spend it. And so we're seeing that quite a bit.
One of the things we really haven't mentioned yet, we were always talking about compression of CO2. The reality is that in many of these applications, it's actually not pure CO2, but CO2 with some other stuff in it. And normally, for many applications, that's really not all that critical, but especially if you have applications that heavily rely on managing dew points, managing the behavior, right, in the supercritical and dense phase requirement, the properties of your gas will change dramatically, even if you have relatively small amounts of water or hydrocarbons or some other contaminants in the gas. And that may require that you actually not only build a machine that's very good at one or two operating points, but you may have to think about how you manage a massive change in density just because you don't know the gas composition with a high precision.
And with that, Rainer has opened a Pandora's box on because once you add or you spike your CO2 with anything, then your critical point moves drastically up and down. And from a turbo machinery perspective, what was already a nightmare is going to be a terrible nightmare, because you really don't know where all your physical properties and how rapidly that you're changing. And especially if you don't know exactly what the actual gas composition is, becomes extremely challenging. With those last words, I'll leave it. We've tortured our audience enough. Thanks, Rainer, for this interesting discussion, and looking forward to another one with you.
Yeah, Klaus, was fun as always.
Thank you for joining us this episode, Klaus and Rainer. Also, a big thank you to our audience for tuning in. Once again, I am your host, James Cook, and we will see you next time.